When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy-O's.
Hi, my name is Shane Terrio, and you are listening to The Riff Raff. Music, stories, and insights from the front line. Riff Raff. Let's get started with today's guest. I decided to start this podcast right where I'm standing at the moment, which is on tour with Daryl Hall and John Oates. So John Oates, as you probably know already if you're listening to this, is one half of the legendary duo Daryl Hall and John Oates, the biggest selling pop duo in history and a recent Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. He's done way more interviews in his life than I've probably ever read or listened to myself. So he's a natural at it, and he's very easy to talk to. John and I have gotten to be good friends over the past few years. He's a great guitar player, great songwriter. I don't feel he gets enough cred for either of these. So I urge you to check out some of his solo records, his latest Good Road to Follow. It's really great. I had the pleasure of working on that. Let's get going. This interview took place inside John's room at the historic Hotel Bethlehem in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. So we'll talk Hall & Oates, song inspiration, how he comes up with his ideas, guitars, pedals, road stories, and we even jam on a little ditty called Man Eater. So it's my first interview, and I hope you like it. Nothing left of this broken heart I brought down to New Orleans. I found a riverboat poker chip.
Where are we? Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
We're in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Historic Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Yes, my old stomping grounds.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, John, thanks for doing this with me, interview.
Man, am I your first guest on the podcast?
Your first guest, man. I start right from go right from the top. You know, I know you've done hundreds and hundreds of interviews, and maybe this is a little unique for you and maybe even a first to have somebody in your band actually interview you. Has that ever happened before?
You know what? You're right about that. I have done lots of interviews, and I don't think I've ever been interviewed by a band member. So this is definitely a first and a cool idea.
Oh, good. Yeah, because I think I'm in a unique spot because I get a little objectivity on hearing you play your own songs every night, which is a unique thing. You know, being a sideman and working with different people, it's a little different because you're playing a lot of your your own signature parts, which is something that, you know, I'm really conscious of that every night. And that's a little different slant.
And not only the fact that, but you get to play with me in the Hall & Oates context in that band,
right?
And play with my solo band as well,
right? Yeah.
Which is two different worlds, as
it
you
is.
Know. So yeah, so it's it is definitely a unique perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever actually had a friend and a player, a musician friend who has played in both bands.
Really?
No,
wow.
I think it's the first time.
Hmm.
It's cool.
Thanks. Well, I guess we should tell the listeners where we first met. I met you in New Orleans when you came down to New Orleans to do your record and played on your record and kind of hit it off.
Yeah.
And then we saw each other again in Japan by fate.
That was fate. It had to be fate. It was meant to be.
It was really strange. Yeah. So,
we should tell it. You want to tell that story?
Yeah.
Because that's, after Shane and I had played together in the studio in New Orleans, we did hit it off, and Shane lent me a beautiful little Martin to play on a song, Lose It in Louisiana, which was awesome. And then, I had been invited by Larry Carlton to go to Japan and be his special guest at the Tokyo Jazz Festival. And we were going to work up a couple songs with Larry Carlton's band. And what had happened was Larry Carlton's son, who was supposed to play bass on that particular show, did not make it on the plane. He got sick. And they were panicking. And their manager called me in the hotel in Tokyo and said, "Man, do you know anybody can play bass?" And Shane was in Japan with his wife, and I said, "Well, man, I know an amazing guitar player, and something tells me he can probably play bass. I didn't want to throw him into the fire, but so I called Shane up and asked him if he wanted to play bass with Larry Carlton, and that's how it all kind of came down.
Yeah, that was a bit of a stressful night. I remember telling Shane, go get me some sake. I'm just going to stay up all night and learn this show.
Well, lucky it was a blues show, but it did get into some of the Larry complicated jazz stuff as well. But that's a whole other part of the story.
I had a chart of room 335 that was probably from the original session. It looked like it had been photocopied 100 times with arrows drawn everywhere. You
Man,
know,
I'll tell you
what. It
wasn't
really that.
Well, I want to tell you folks out there, Shane is an amazing guitar player, and he is also a pretty amazing bass player because he covered it, and not only did he cover it, he nailed it. And I think everyone was very impressed with that, and the fact that he pulled it together in 24 hours and rearranged this entire trip, and then ended up playing with Larry on a few of his other Japanese dates. So the whole thing came together in a very cool way.
It did, and then we met. Let's see. No, I went back to Japan right after that. That's what. But then I got a call from you. Sometime during that time, we had been talking, and here we are. So it's like a year and a half later.
Well, I was, you know, I just had, Shane and I hit it off, and I was so impressed with his playing, and I just thought that what he brought to the recording session and what he brought live, I felt would be a real asset to the Hall & Oates band. And the first thing I did was call Daryl. And I said to Daryl, you know, ever since T-Bone Wolk left this earth and left our band, you know, we had a number of great guitar players and, you know, in the band. We've always had great players in our bands. But there was something missing. It was something, a presence missing and a kind of a commanding leadership presence missing. And I thought Shane might be the guy who could fill that. And I really convinced Daryl that he should give Shane a listen and may get to know him. And it was a cool thing that Shane went up to New York and hung out with Daryl. And eventually, you know, now he is the MD and the lead guitar player in the band. And it's fantastic. It's really brought our whole level up, I think.
Well, I don't take it lightly. I appreciate that, John. And I'm glad to be here.
Yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned T-Bone. Unfortunately, I never did get to meet T-Bone. Mm-hmm. I did stand probably 6 feet from him and watch, you know, his back was turned when we did the... Years ago, we did a show together. I was with the Neville Brothers, Endymion Parade.
I remember that. I remember 2 o'clock in the morning at the Superdome.
Insane. Yeah, and I remember standing. I saw T-Bone, and there was a Leslie cabinet, the B3, and I remember going, "Man, shit, this is so funky." It was No Can Do, and I was like, "Wow." And now I just, you know, I wish I could have met T-Bone. I mean, I know a lot of people that knew T-Bone, and I feel like I know him because I'm kind of. I'm in his world.
You're kind of standing in his footsteps for real, you know, even though he did play bass and eventually he played guitar, but, you know, he played everything great. Yeah, I mean, you know, Shane, you know, this thing about the Hall & Oates band is that it has a history of having these amazing players.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, think about the guitar players that we have. You know, it started with Chris Bond and Todd Sharp and then up through Caleb Quay and, you know, of course, G.E. Smith through the 80s and Paul Pesco and, you know, so many great guitar players.
Absolutely.
So it's a chair, so to speak, that has been pretty legendary over the years. And I think you... you know, man, you are definitely taken to another level. So I'm very happy about it.
One of the things I really respect about you and Daryl is your ability to, you know, the way you like to, you like your guys around and you get the best players you can and the personalities bond. I mean, these are such a great bunch of guys, man, personalities. Nobody has any vices. Everybody gets along.
Yep.
It's like, I have to look over my shoulder a lot of times and just say, is this for real? Because I'm used to like some volatility somewhere, some personality clashes.
Well, you know,
everybody gets along, man. It's almost too easy. And you and Daryl just let guys do what they do. And I got to say, being, you know, working with people, recording, blah, 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 being on stage, you and Daryl, you know, the creative leash that I have, the wide girth that I'm able to stretch with respect to the song is pretty amazing because you'll tell me if something's not right, but most of the time, either I'm doing it right, or you're just letting me try things, which is an amazing. I got to tell you, to be a sideman and have this kind of freedom is few and far between. You know.
Well, you know, we both you know, we're firm believers that you surround yourself with good people and let them do what they do. And of course, it, as you said, you know, you do have to, you know, it has to be within the confines of the arrangement.
Sure.
And in some ways, you know, some of the stuff is very written. And when I say written, it's not physically written on paper, but it's written over the years in the recordings and some of the signature licks and signature things like intros and certain solos that are actually, you know, the actual original recording, it becomes part of the arrangement. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the cool part is that you pay tribute and you're faithful to that aspect of it. But then when in the moments when you can do your own thing and be your own, you know, bring your own element and your own creativity to it, we let that happen. And that is, that's been really, you're right about that. That's been something we've always done over the years.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so rare in today's...
Well, I wouldn't know. I've never been in another band.
Well, I mean, you know, okay, well, you live in Nashville part-time,
yeah.
So Nashville is completely different.
Yeah.
You know, it's you basically have studio guys and you mm-hmm. have... L.A., that line is a little more blurred in New York, but to me, it's like you when you commit to a band, it's like you're a sideman, but it kind of is a band. Almost.
Oh, it's a band. You know? Daryl and I have always thought of ourselves as two guys with a band.
Yeah.
It's a band. I mean, the sound that we've done over the years has always been created by a band. In the early days, of course, it was a studio musicians, but we still treated it the same way. And we had the type of studio musicians who just didn't phone it in, you know, they
yeah.
came to play. And,
yeah.
and you know, I think a lot of times it's a testament to the songs. I think good players like to play good songs.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So when you have good songs, it makes it more,
I know,
more fun.
I do. Talk about the songs.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of people would love to hear about your songwriting. You know, the other day I heard you say something interesting. I think it was when we did the Howard Stern show. You said that you and Daryl had never made a conscious attempt to put any more effort into one song over another.
Mm-hmm.
Like you basically didn't try to design a hit.
Mm-hmm.
You just wrote songs.
That's
and you
true.
Put the same attention to detail into every song. Some of them just took off and other
That's
ones
right.
did. I mean, what do you think in today's, is that still your approach to songwriting now? Or?
Absolutely. Every time I sit down to write a song, whether it's by myself or with someone else, I try to write the best song I can. I try to throw all the rules out the window. I try to not be chained to my past. You know, a lot of times, you know, you always lean on certain things that you know work, you know, whether it's a chord progression or a groove or a riff or whatever. But, you know, the thing for me is that, you know, I just want to, I just think every songwriting session is an opportunity to write a great song. It never, you know, seldom happens. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, at least you have that chance every time. And as you said, we really spent as much time on every song. There wasn't one song we went, it's just going to be an album track. Let's just do one take on it and get it done and you know, put some vocals on it. We're finished. We never even thought on those terms at all.
Mm-hmm.
Every song was fully realized to the best of its ability and or to the best of our ability. And then you know, the world gets involved, you know,
right.
the record company,
yeah,
the radio guys, you know, the A&R guys, you know, hey, man, this is one, man, this is the hit. And, you know, sure, some of those songs do rise to the top, and the ones that rise to the top were the hits. But that's, I think, one of my biggest pet peeves over the years, especially with rock critics, was that we were this kind of hit-making machine who had this secret pact with the devil who knew how to just create this hit record. That's bullshit, because if it was easy, everyone would do it. That's the first thing. And secondly, it's just a matter of certain things all coming together. You know, a great song, a great lyric, it has to be in sync with the times. It has to reflect what people are thinking about.
Sure, yeah.
And it has to lodge into their brain, like worm into their brain, like a disease, where they just can't get that hook out of their head, you know?
Yeah. Well, you see that. Yeah, no can do. People immediately get up and dance.
Man, well,
and
that's...
Just, It's one
so
of those things,
simple.
Man.
That groove is so simple.
But it's iconic, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those things. Michael Jackson say he took the groove for Billie
Jean?
Yeah,
you know, he didn't say it obviously, but he
influenced him strongly.
Oh, absolutely. He said he came backstage one time. We played in L.A., and he and his brothers came back, and they hung out in the dressing room. And he said, man, he goes, I danced to No Can Do in front of my mirror in my bedroom.
Wow.
And then he said, man, I love that groove. And then when Billie Jean came out, it was pretty obvious that was the starting point for him. But, you know, I don't look at it. I look at it as a compliment. I look at it like, I think the entire tree of rock and roll from the roots on up is built upon the things that came before it.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
Everything I do is predicated and influenced and informed somehow or another on you know, by the music that I heard. Whether I heard it yesterday or I heard it, you know, when I was a kid, it doesn't matter. Somehow it's lodged in there and you know, somehow or another it's going to come out.
Yeah, I mean, everything is sort of derivative from something. I mean,
yeah.
Even if it's...
There's
if,
very
if
few
comes
true
out
originals.
Subconsciously or
yeah,
not, it's...
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite song that you like to play every night?
Well, you know,
I know you have your whole solo repertoire too.
Yeah,
maybe
I mean,
something from that, and then maybe something from.
I just say that, you know, it's for me. It's She's Gone. There's something.
Yeah.
There's this magical quality about that song. It is so right on so many levels. And you know, if I can look at it in a lot of ways. You know, I can look at it from a songwriter's point of view because I co-wrote it with Daryl. I can look at it from a singer's point of view. Because it's an amazing song to sing. I can look at it from a player's point of view because the chord changes are really unique and awesome.
Yeah.
And I look at it from being part of a band, you know, playing my part in the arrangement. So many ways to break that song down, but it doesn't matter. You take the overall effect of what happens, and when that modulation happens, I mean, I like to joke that Daryl and I got all our modulations out in one song because we very seldom modulated for the rest of our career.
Yeah.
But it's kind of funny, but it's not really funny because it has this majesty. It just goes to this other, and the really unique part of the song is this in the key of E. But there's not one tonic chord
in this whole song.
Yeah,
it's the four. It's a really great. That modulation is just epic, man. When it breaks down and there's that big hole and you can hear the delay trail off and it's like, and it's a big modulation. It's like a minor third or something.
Yeah, it's three half step modulations. Yeah.
Yeah, that is a great one. I never thought about that. All those. There's a lot of chords in that song.
There's a lot of chords in that song. And you know what? But they all work, and it all works. It's, you know, the verse, you know, is something Daryl. It's very Daryl, the verse, by pedaling the B, mm-hmm. B note, you know, mm-hmm. over the A major into B major. Mm-hmm. That pedal tone piano thing, that's a very signature Daryl thing. I wrote the chorus, and when I wrote the chorus, it sounded like a folk song. It sounded like a Cat Stevens song.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, of course, as the arrangement took a shape in the studio and it became more of a, you know, whatever acoustic R&B or electric R&B song it was, you know, that we modified various things. But it's just a combination of my chord changes in the chorus and Daryl's chord changes in the verse. And they just perfectly blend together in this seamless, you know, seamless.
You know, one thing I can tell me if I'm wrong, but just sort of a. Being involved in some of the arranging and transcribing a bunch of the songs and writing charts, it seems that you you know, mm-hmm. you are primarily yeah. a guitar player. And Daryl was mainly keyboards, and he took up guitar later. So right. you had, like, Daryl had the keyboard voicings and those things yes. in his head, and you came from the more folk rock mm-hmm. guitar thing, and that's that right. seemed like a really great blend.
Yeah, it's true, and that's exactly what happened. And he and I both learned from each other, and we both then transferred that information. Like, I had to realign and relearn and rediscover how my guitar playing evolved, because I had to play with a piano player, because he had such unusual voicings and he had the piano style voicings. So I had to adapt my fingerings and my chord progressions to play like with the songs that he would initiate or write. And then he didn't know anything about American traditional music. You know, he was totally a doo-wop street corner, mm-hmm. you know, and classically trained. So he got into all the modal stuff and the folky stuff and the bluesy stuff that I was doing. And then, you know, of course, then in later years, as you said, he started moving to the guitar because he really wanted to play guitar. And then I ended up taking piano lessons because I felt like my music theory was a bit weak in the early 70s. And I went and took a bunch of music theory courses, which, of course, I had to do on piano. So it enabled me to understand a little bit more about that aspect of things now. So I don't write on piano very much, but I have written on piano over the years.
Yeah, it forces you to see things
in
a more unconventional. Yeah,
you think
break
differently.
Out of your patterns.
The rhythms are
patterns.
Different. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Who were some of your early influences on guitar?
Well, you know, in the earliest times when I first started playing, because I started playing super young. I was only 6 when I started playing. I played three chord country songs. I remember playing Oh Lonesome Me by Don Gibson. I played some Everly Brothers stuff. I played some Buddy Holly stuff. So that was, you know, kind of country and kind of rockabilly that was really easy to play as a little kid. And eventually, you know, Chuck Berry became a huge influence on me. I had to learn all the Chuck Berry stuff.
Sure, yeah.
And then I liked to play Little Richard stuff, even though he played it on piano. You know, to me, that's the shuffle, his swing and shuffle was just amazing.
Yeah.
From there, I moved from the early roots rock and roll. I moved into folk music and blues, Delta blues, Appalachian. You know, bluegrass. I'm not a very good bluegrass player, but I liked it. And, you know, that kind of stuff. And then eventually Curtis Mayfield was a huge influence on me. The fact that he played and sang at the same time was very unique as an R&B performer. Not many R&B performers did that. Blues players did, of course, but not pop R&B guys. And, you know, he used a capo sometimes, mm-hmm. which was kind of folky
yeah,
in a way.
Yeah.
So I began to see how, you know, that my folky influences could be, you know, adapted into the world of, like, more like urban R&B. And so he was kind of a real key person to me. And then when I first heard Jimi Hendrix, I just, you know, the first thing that I realized was he was just playing Curtis Mayfield really loud. And that was one of the things that immediately I understood. And then, you know, of course, his soloing and his experimental
stuff.
Did
you ever see Hendrix live?
No, man, it's a bummer. Because
I know Daryl's his.
Daryl saw him.
Yeah.
Daryl went, and I was supposed to go with Daryl, and I just, for some reason, I didn't go. I don't know why I didn't go.
But he says it wasn't that good.
Well,
he said maybe it was an off night. I don't know. But
you know, that doesn't surprise me, because the reality of it is, if you know, compared to today and the type of live shows and the sound and the PA systems and things that we have now, you think back to his early shows, they may have been very vibey, but a lot of them didn't really sound very good.
He was just so primitive.
And, you know,
yeah.
Daryl's listening with a very, you know, very
yes,
critical ear.
Very critical.
You know, so. But I did see the band back in the early 1970, and they blew my mind. I thought they were amazing. Let's go play a song.
Let's go play a song.
And I will play the changes.
You play the changes, and I'll play them, and then we can just trade.
Okay, just trade? I'll solo first, then.
Okay, great. All right, you solo first. So, Maneater?
Yeah, let's go. Ready? Are we recording?
Yeah, man.
Right.
You can come. Thank you.
I seen her here before. Watching and waiting, baby. She's in it for you, but her eyes are on the door. Then I have paid to see. I said, what do you think? You're getting free. No, the woman is a wild. Well, does she get tamed by the purr of a jaguar?
That's a great arrangement, man.
Yeah, that's cool. All right.
Did you always use we're talking guitar geek technical stuff. Did you always use a dual guitar amp setup? Like, I know now you're stereo, right?
Yeah,
has it always been like that?
No, actually, that's been more, kind of a recent thing. I probably started that around 2000. I didn't really rely on a very elaborate pedal board in the old days. Mm-hmm. My thing was usually a tuner, a wah-wah pedal, and an overdrive, and a chorus.
Yeah. Yeah, and else you need. That's pretty much
I played with that, you know, through the 70s and 80s. That's probably all I ever used. Hmm. Then later on, I started adding more things. I think what happened was really, well, there was a bunch of circumstances. When T-Bone switched from bass to guitar and Daryl started playing more guitar, I started rethinking my parts in the Hall & Oates set because there was too much guitar playing going on. And I just thought, well, someone's got to do something different. So rather than stick with my original parts, which I had played for many, many years, I actually reinvented a lot of my guitar parts, and I made them much more I started to think more broadly and thought about chords, mm-hmm. and just in terms of laying down a lot of, you know, just making sure the harmonics of the chords were being heard,
mm-hmm.
and I became more conscious. So as I did that, I wanted sounds that just had a little bit more color to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I began adding a little bit more, like I started using a Line 6 device, multi-effects device that had various chorus, dimension D, various delays, mm-hmm. things that would give my broad chordal bass a little bit more color and interest.
Right.
And I started going in that route. So I added that stuff, and then I started getting into my delays a little bit more. So that was really more recent in the 2000s that I started doing that.
Yeah, I remember in Japan you had that Line 6 thing, and it sounded great. I think you had two deluxes in the Line 6. And
yeah,
that was
you know, the Line 6, you know, I don't care for the compressed kind of, it kind of thins you out a bit. There's something about the inherent quality of them. But for a run-and-gun type mm-hmm, show, mm-hmm. and I use the Line 6 M9 box all the time, especially I learned that I got asked to jam all the time with people. I started hanging with jam bands and started, like, playing, you know, with all these different groups. And every time I'd play, all of a sudden I found this Line 6 M9 box, and I realized I could do pretty much everything I needed to do with that little box. So if I showed up at a gig with it, and I have it in a little SBK mic case.
Mm-hmm.
So if I showed up at the gig, I could just plug it in. Didn't matter whose amp I was playing through. I could always get something that was respectable. So that's become my little pocket, you know, way to travel.
It's good to have
travel.
Something consistent, too.
Yeah.
And sometimes less is more. And
exactly.
The less shit you have.
Yeah.
The guitar, the Strat you're playing now, it's a pretty iconic guitar.
Yeah.
It's on the cover of Bigger Than Both of Us, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you had Seymour Duncan mm-hmm. redo the pickups and everything. Would you say that's your favorite electric guitar?
Yeah, without a doubt.
Okay.
I started using that guitar in 1973. In 1972, I was using an SG stand, a Les Paul Special. A cream colored, like a taffy colored Les Paul Special that I bought from a friend of my brother. A guy I knew in grade school, his older brother had it. And I knew his brother had quit playing guitar, and I knew it was in his attic. And I think I bought it from him around 1971 or 72. And I played it for the first 2 years that I worked with Daryl. But I never liked it.
Was that P90 pickups?
Yeah, two P90s. Oh. And the neck was chunky, and it just was a cool guitar, and I played it because it was a cool guitar, not because
you're not
I'm
a chunky neck guy.
No, I'm not. And I played it just because it was the only good guitar I had. But when I sold that guitar, I bought the 58 Strat from a drug dealer in New York for $150.
Wow.
Yeah, and I had it routed out, and boy, if you ever saw under the pick guard, it is the ugliest thing you've ever seen in your life. It looks like somebody routed it out with
a
chisel.
It's on YouTube, right?
Oh,
there's
yeah.
Guy, if anybody wants to see that.
It's... When Seymour Duncan takes the pick guard off, because I had redone it as a Strat, you know, Strat configuration, it's the ugliest thing you've ever seen. It's all hollow. The entire guitar is hollow.
Wow.
And I think it has something to do with its sound.
I'm sure
First of all, it's ash. It's light wood to start with. The guitar is very light. But it has a lot of brass parts. In those days, in the early 70s, putting brass stuff like all your, you know, your tune-o-matic bridges. And
that was considered an upgrade.
That was a big upgrade. Yeah, brass plates on the back, you know, a brass cover for the strings on the back. And I'd always block the vibrato handle. I never used the vibrato ever. So there's a wood block in there holding it, you know, steady. I'd rather have it in tune. But that guitar, just there's something about the neck of that guitar.
Mm-hmm.
If I ever had a guitar again, you know, in fact, I've had some built, and I've tried to replicate that neck. Nothing ever quite feels 100% the same.
No, of course.
But I've got a couple that are close. Yeah. A couple custom shop strats that are actually very close to it. That gold strat that you played on my DVD?
Yeah. That's a great guitar.
That's a copy of that neck.
Oh, I see. Yeah. That's like an old shoe, man.
Yeah,
that's
it is. Great. Something about it, I can just put my hands on it. It's perfect. Yeah, it's an awesome guitar. And the P90s, I mean, I'm sorry, the humbuckers that are in it, one is a real 1959 PAF in the bridge. In the bridge. And by the neck was an original Seymour Duncan from the early 70s.
Wow.
Which he then took out and replaced with a modern Seymour Duncan 59 PAF replica.
Ah.
So the way he fixed it and put it back together, it's rocking. I mean, it
sounds great.
It's as good as
every night.
I'll ever need
great.
It. Yeah.
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 Oh, I know what I wanted to ask you. What's your favorite memory of the We Are the World session? Do you have any favorite?
I do. I have lots of favorite memories of that session. My favorite memory was being a fly on the wall in the middle of that group of singers, watching the interaction between the performers and who kind of was like out of their element by not having their entourage and not having their handlers. And who felt uncomfortable, who felt comfortable. And I was, Bob Dylan was right over my right shoulder. He was right behind me. And I had some small talk with him, but he was very shy. And I think he was very intimidated. I don't think he had ever been in a situation like that in his life. I mean, Bob Dylan, you know, obviously coming from where he's coming, he never sang in an ensemble group, ever. You know, so he was a little bit... I think he was a little, not intimidated, but I think he was, you know, kind of felt like, wow.
Well, everybody was out of there. Daryl described it as a high school choir. As soon as the handlers left, it turned into, nobody knew what to, they couldn't have a conversation.
Right. But I had, Ray Charles was in front of me, two rows down, and I could see the top of his head right off my left shoulder. Like I could reach out and touch him. And for me, he was the coolest because he didn't take any shit from anybody. And as soon as anybody would try to disrupt the flow, he was like, he would just say something. He would like, and everybody would shut up. Whatever Ray said, everybody would just shut up. And he was like, because people were starting to like be creative, you know, like as the thing was going down, everybody started making suggestions.
Everybody
you know.
Was producing.
Well, they were all their own bosses. You know, you had all the stars in the solar system were all in one place. So Michael and Lionel and Quincy Jones were trying to keep it all going in one direction because, you know, it was their song. They had a vision for it. And so as people began to disrupt the flow, Ray Charles would just keep piping up. And he'd go, man, shut up. He'd go, shut up. Let Michael and Lionel, let them do their thing. It's their song. Yeah. Come on, let's just sing. You know, and every time he spoke up, people shut up. So it was great. I mean, he's Ray Charles.
What's the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to you on stage?
A couple things. I think the one that stands out in my mind was in the we had this show that we did in the 70s when we got big after Rich Girl, She's Gone and Sarah Smile hit. We put up this show that had this big giant star as a backdrop, and it was a mechanical star, right? And it had lights in it and flashing, and it had these two runways that went from the side of the stage, from downstage, all the way behind the band and would meet at the star. And on the last song of the show, we did this song called Bad Habits and Infections, and it was called, and Daryl would dress up in a doctor's suit. And I had this giant syringe. It was like 4 feet long. And I would come out and I would inject Daryl. And then I would drag him up these walkway to the star. And at that point, at the end of the show, the band was, because it was a heavy rock song, the band was rocking. The star would open up. Like split
very
in half.
Tap.
Yeah, it was very totally Spinal Tap. The star would split in half and Daryl and I would go inside it. And the star would close, and that was the end of the show. So one night, we go through this whole routine, and we run up to the top of the steps, and the star didn't open. And so there we are, just standing up there like a bunch of assholes. And the band is like going bang, gang, 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 right, like this. And the roadies are underneath us, about 5-6 feet below us, going, jump, jump. Because we couldn't come back down because we had already made our grand exit, you know. It was really stupid. Like, it was about as stupid as it gets. Yeah, that was our Spinal Tap moment, without doubt. And I remember we had to jump into the arms of the waiting roadies below us.
And where's the Star now?
I think it still exists. You know, I can't believe Daryl hasn't like put it in his backyard by now.
Put it in the back of the club.
No, that would be something that he would do. In fact, I don't know why he hasn't done it.
Like you've never fallen down on stage or anything like
that? Yeah, you know, there was a corner in the back going off stage in the dark. And usually, a lot of times, I'll put Dayglo tape around a corner. Like, you know, it was, because our stage was elevated. You know, it's probably a good 8 feet off the ground. And I went back to walk back off stage on the encore. And for some reason, it wasn't lit. And I took a step, and next thing I knew, I was on my back.
Oh, shit.
And I was stretched out over the top of the lighting truss, the base of the lighting truss. So it had these legs, and there were spikes coming up, like where they would, you know, hold it down with these bolts. And the spike was in between my arm and the guitar, like this. Had it gone on my back, it would have probably killed me, yeah. And I tweaked my shoulder. I think I tore something in my collarbone or something. And I was on my back with my guitar on my chest. The spike was up through my arm and in between my arm and the guitar. And I got up and they picked me up and I went back out and finished the show. But that was crazy. And then one time in the 90s, I remember Daryl was singing Sarah Smile and he walked to the front of the stage and he just fell straight off.
Wow.
He fell straight down. He kept singing. It was really funny. He kept singing and these big bouncers were pushing him back up onto the stage. It was pretty funny.
We actually need to go to sound check. Could you share a good T-Bone story with me? You know, I know I've heard all about the safety sandwiches and a bunch of other things, but...
There's just so many. You know, he was allergic to all kinds of food, but he loved to
Which
eat.
Which is ironic because he was loved like, to eat everything.
Right? Yeah, and he was like a short order cook. He was a great, like, short order cook. I don't know. I'll tell you. Maybe I shouldn't share this story because it's really weird. He got some kind of fungus on his scrotum one time. And I swear to God, and I know it doesn't matter, you know, he's not around. He can't come back and get me. Maybe he's looking down in heaven. He's going to come back and do something to me. But the doctor told him he was supposed to soak his nuts in milk. And so at the end of every show on our tour rider, he had to have a bowl of milk. And he had to soak his nuts in milk. And I swear to God, as crazy as it sounds, it made the fungus go away. Don't ask me where, you know, what the hell it was. Maybe we were in Europe.
The doctor actually told him to do this?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, and there was some, but the guy was just, he was a gem. He was like one of these people that I just, you know, can't say enough about. A lot of times, you know, even to this day, you know, if I'm in a studio or if I'm writing something or playing, a lot of times I think, how would he have done this? I really do. I actually
think
about it.
What would T-Bone
do? What would he do? Like, how would he have played this? Because he had a lot of little tricks, you know, because he had a wide encyclopedic knowledge of music in terms of, you know, he could play folk music, he could play R&B, play blues, he could play jazz, he could play anything. So he'd always have a lot of tricks, a lot of open string tricks and tuning. A lot of times he'd use a capo and play in different inversions, and I'd always watch the way he would approach things. So he always had an interesting approach for stuff, you know, and I try to use those same kind of, you know, techniques.
He used a capo with an electric guitar on the gig, too?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he played You Make My Dreams in E position.
Oh, okay.
One fret, capoed on the first fret.
Yeah.
So he's playing, in, you know, still technically an F, but he's playing in the open E shape.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
sure.
As the bluegrass guys play, clamp one, play E. E shape. Clamp one, E shape.
Or is Bobby Rush, that was in the studio with him, and he goes, hey, could I use your cheater?
Cheater, right. Yeah, the first time I was at Telluride Bluegrass Festival, and I asked what key they were in, the guy told me, clamp two, G shape. I'm like, okay, got it.
All right. Well, I appreciate you doing this, John.
Yeah, man, that's good. It's always fun to talk music.
All right. Well, that was a lot of fun. Thank you, John Oates. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this episode of Riff Raff. I'd like to give a shout out to the folks at TrueFire.com for helping sponsor this. Check them out. They've got some amazing educational, instructional videos out there. The music you're listening to today is from my solo record, Highway 90. It's called Trashy. So if you like what you hear, you like this podcast, help me spread the word.
Visit me at ShaneTerrio.com. Thanks.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.